Well, welcome everyone. I think we'll get started. My name is Scott Kirshner. I'm the village pastor. Most of you probably know that. And we are going to be looking today, I've titled this Bible study, The Human One is Lord Even of the Sabbath, Sabbath Controversies in the Gospel of Mark. And the controversies surrounding the Sabbath and the proper observance of it are kind of a major theological issue in Mark's gospel. And so I thought it would be interesting to trace that together and look at what's that all about and what's at stake there and what is the Sabbath all about anyway. And so as a way of doing that, I thought, I'm sorry about the weakness of the color on the board here, but I thought we'd start by looking at a little bit at the Old Testament statements about the Sabbath, and so what that background is, and then go into Mark's Gospel and look at how the controversies about the Sabbath unfold, what Jesus is all about, what that conflict is all about, and what that says theologically about the message that that Jesus brings, and that the Gospel of Mark, in particular, is trying to convey to us. So let's start with looking at Exodus 20, verse 8. Exodus 20, verse 8. Exodus is the second book in the Old Testament after Genesis. And would someone care to read that?
What chapter was it again, Scott?
20. Exodus 20, verse 8.
Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy.
Nope. You know what? I meant all the way through 11.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
All right.
Sorry.
6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or your daughter, your male or your female slave, your livestock, or the alien resident in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, but rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it.
Thank you. So this is, of course, the context of the Ten Commandments, this being the third commandment, or fourth, depending on how you number them. There's controversy about that, too. But at any rate, it's a familiar commandment, and the commandment of honoring the Sabbath day. What's the rationale in how this commandment is stated here? What is the reason for observation of the Sabbath?
The way God created the earth.
Okay, so it's rooted in creation. Mm-hmm. Yep, right. So it's rooted in creation. It's rooted in it's going back to the Genesis creation account, right? Mm-hmm. And God rested, therefore you also shall rest. And who's included in this rest?
Pretty much everybody.
Right.
Everyone in your household.
Even the cows.
Even the cows, right. Even the livestock are included in this rest. So it is a rest for all creation, in a sense, right? And it's rooted in creation itself. Let's now look at Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy 5:12. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 5:12. Did I get that?
Yeah.
We want to extend it all the way down to 12 to 15. So Deuteronomy 5:12 to 15.
No working on the Sabbath. Keep it holy, just as God, your God, commanded you. Work 6 days, doing everything you have to do. But the seventh day is a Sabbath, a rest day. No work, not you, your son, your daughter, your servant, your maid, your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, and not even the foreigner visiting your town. That way your servants and maids will get the same rest as you. Don't ever forget that you were slaves in Egypt, and God, your God, got you out of there in a powerful show of strength. That's why God, your God, commands you to observe the day of Sabbath rest.
Thank you. So Deuteronomy, this is there are two places in the Old Testament that the Ten Commandments appear. One's in Exodus, one's in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is presented as a sort of a valedictory speech by Moses before he dies. And he's kind of recalling the 40 years that they've had together. A long time. And coming out of Egypt and the 40 years in the wilderness. And here again are the Ten Commandments. Here again is the commandment to observe the Sabbath. Why now? Here, or what is the justification given for the Sabbath here?
Your God commanded you.
Well, but yes, but
because you were slaves,
yes.
You have to be fair to your slaves as well.
Right, right. There's a different rationale given for the Sabbath here than in Exodus. In Exodus, it's rooted in creation. God rested, therefore you rest. Here, it's you were slaves, and God set you free. Therefore, don't be enslaved to work. Don't be enslaved to work, and don't let anyone else be enslaved to work either, including your ox, your donkeys, your livestock, the resident aliens in your land. And this comes to deeply connect then, of course, also with the notion of the Jubilee year, the 49th year of when all debts would be canceled, when all slaves would be freed, when social justice and equality would be in any way built up in society, that it would be renewed, that there would be kind of this redistribution of wealth every 50th year, 49th or 50th. Is it 49th or 50th? 7 times 7 is 49. I think it's 49th year. This Sabbath observance then has this deep kind of social justice desire. And it's rooted both in the theology of the Old Testament. It's rooted both in the order of creation itself. But also it's rooted in God's saving action to the people. So with that as a little bit of background, let us move to Mark. Mark chapter 1. Verses 21 to 34. Would someone care to read that?
They went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath had come, he entered the synagogue and taught. They were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes. Just then, there was in the synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you done? What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. They were all amazed, and they kept on asking each other, "What is this, a new teaching with authority? He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." At once his fame began to spread throughout the surrounding region of Galilee. As soon as they had left the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told him about her at once. He came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. Then the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That evening, at sunset, they brought to him all who were sick or possessed with demons, and the whole city was gathered around the door. And he cured many who were sick with various diseases, and cast out many demons, and he would not permit the demons to speak, because they knew him.
So, this is a scene here that begins to unfold on the Sabbath. It's kind of Jesus' first public event of his ministry after he calls the first disciples. And who is he? Who is his authority being contrasted to here?
The scribes.
The local religious authorities. In the synagogue. Do you suppose that they took kindly to him coming in and taking over the show?
No.
I highly doubt it. In fact, it'll be in chapter 3 when we read that they call for reinforcements and they have scribes come all the way from Jerusalem to check this guy out, which is really means kind of government investigators, right? Because scribes from Jerusalem, that means that those are people who are basically running the whole show and probably close allies with the Romans. So what unfolds here has major, major repercussions. And Jesus is immediately in conflict with those who are the established religious authorities. And it happens on the Sabbath, right? An important point to keep in mind. I want you to look at verse 32. That evening, at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or possessed with demons, and the whole city was gathered around, and he cured many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. What do you know about how the Hebrew days, how in the Hebrew way of understanding, Jewish way of understanding, the days beginning and end?
They begin at sundown.
Begin at sundown and ends at sundown, right? So,
they were in the period where they couldn't do anything, right?
There are various ways of understanding Sabbath observance, but yes. That ends the period of the Sabbath rest. So in verse 32 then, it's an important thing that's being said there about time, and that is that it's somehow the Sabbath is over. That evening at sundown, the Sabbath that had been going on is over, and it's at that point that all these people come to him and he begins to heal them. It's an important point, because when we get to chapter 3, there will be a man who has a withered hand on the Sabbath. And Jesus deliberately, very deliberately, it almost appears like an act of civil disobedience, he very deliberately heals him on the Sabbath while people are looking on, seething at him for doing this. But at this point, in the beginning of the story, he seems to avoid riling them up too much. And so nothing happens until after the Sabbath is over. At least the healings don't happen until after the Sabbath is over. And in chapter 3, what's going to get him in a great deal of trouble is that he will in fact heal on the Sabbath, and then the plot in his life starts to begin.
Didn't he start healing on the Sabbath here with the first person and the mother-in-law with the fever?
Well, I think there's a distinction between casting out demons and healing here. At least in the controversy with the way that at least they're understanding what's permissible and what's not. I think there's a distinction between casting out demons and healing, and I think the part of the point with Simon's mother-in-law being healed is that that's private. It's in the home. He's not sort of like doing this big in public yet, in a way that is going to really be an act of defiance, if you will, before the authorities. But that is a very interesting point. That I mean, the casting out the demon in the synagogue does happen on the Sabbath. The commentaries that I've read suggest that there was a bit of a distinction in terms of Sabbath observance between those two things, and that healing would have been considered sort of work in a way that the other wouldn't have. But so in this first scene, though, we do see the issue of Sabbath being a time of controversy and conflict with Jesus and his opponents and his healing ministry beginning. So let's look now at Mark 2:23, starting at verse 23, and then going on to chapter 3, verse 6. These are two different scenes. In fact, why don't we break it up and first look at verses 23 to 27. Let's start there. Would someone care to read that?
One Sabbath day, he was walking through a field of ripe grain. As his disciples made a path, they pulled off heads of grain. The Pharisees told on them to Jesus, "Look, your disciples are breaking Sabbath rules." Jesus said, "Really? Haven't you read what David did when he was hungry along with those who were with him? How he entered the sanctuary and ate fresh bread off the altar, with the chief priest Abiathar right there watching, holy bread that no one but priests were allowed to eat, and handed it out to his companions?" Then Jesus said, "The Sabbath was made to serve us. We weren't made to serve the Sabbath. The Son of Man is no lackey to the Sabbath. He's in charge."
What translation are you reading?
I'm using the Message.
The Message, okay. He's no lackey.
Yeah, I like that.
It's not the NIV.
Right. Good. Okay, so again, Sabbath. Here we see the Pharisees kind of showing up in the scene. And the Pharisees are the ones who really get inflamed about what Jesus is doing on the Sabbath. And part of the reason is for that, I think, that the Pharisees were a movement. We think of the Pharisees as being these kind of super legalists, because that's how they're represented in the Gospels. But as a movement within first century Judaism, they're better characterized as kind of religious liberals in a lot of ways. They were a movement, kind of a lay movement, that wanted to not focus on the Jerusalem temple and all of that as much as focusing on living the following the Torah in their own in our communities and our own lives. They wanted to think a lot about observing Sabbath, and they wanted to think a lot in terms of kind of purity in these sorts of things in everyday life, and they come into conflict with Jesus because of all this. But they were a movement that really wanted to talk about, well, how do we kind of, as faithful Jewish people, integrate God's teaching into our lives? That's what they were all about. And they wanted, you know, the average person on the street to do that. And but as part of that, they were very interested in matters of purity and Sabbath observance. And so you really see them getting into conflict with Jesus here, and conflict with him about doing work, plucking grain on the Sabbath. What takes precedence for Jesus over the legalism of not doing work here?
Hunger.
Hunger. Human need. Human need is the deeper concern for Jesus. And that this Sabbath observance then, going back to the Exodus, the passage we read in Exodus, that the Sabbath was about well-being. Sabbath was about being free, especially when we talked about how it's represented in Deuteronomy, about connecting it with the Exodus and with not being enslaved. And so having a life that is full and human flourishing, being and not even just human, but all the animals and all creation. And so Jesus really takes them on, and I think he's taking them on from the kind of root of what Sabbath was and is. As he says that humankind, the Sabbath was made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath. And so the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. And it's in the title of this Bible study, I said provocatively, the human one is Lord even of the Sabbath. And that's a way of translating what is usually translated Son of Man. It's basically a way of saying a person, right? Son of Man. Son of a human being, a human one. So some people have translated it human one. And so I just translated it that way, said it that way in the title of this. But I think that's going to be a really interesting point as we go forward here. Let's look at the next passage then, the one that follows right on the heels of this, and it's, again, a Sabbath controversy. Would someone care to read that? Verses 1 to 6, chapter 3.
Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. They watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come forward." Then he said to them, Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save a life or to kill?" But they were silent. He looked around at them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him how to destroy him.
It's the beginning of chapter 3, and the plot to kill him has already started. The very beginning. 16 chapters, the Gospel of Mark is. Chapter 3, it's already beginning. So what do we notice here about what's going on here? This is a pretty intense scene. It almost seems like a very dramatic and almost has a character of kind of civil disobedience in the kind of dramatic and almost staged disobedience that happens here.
But he challenges them with an extreme hypothesis. Is it better to heal or to cure
mm-hmm.
or to kill on the Sabbath?
Mm-hmm.
And so they were silent.
Right.
And he got mad.
Yeah, yeah.
It said, okay, I'll show you.
Mm-hmm. Right. So he's in the synagogue. This is presumably the same synagogue that he had been at in chapter 1. He's still in, it seems he's still in Capernaum. So this is likely the same synagogue, where he probably now has both allies and enemies, because he had been in there before and had sort of outdone the resident authority, religious leaders, when he had been in there before. And so they're ready for him, right? You can see in chapter 2, or sorry, verse 2, you know, they watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. Right, so they're loaded for bear here, and you know, so We can only guess that there are a lot of people who were there the previous, whether it's the previous week or how long ago it was, but that had been at that same synagogue when Jesus had been there before. And his whatever happened then when they were plucking grain on the Sabbath previously, no doubt informed people too. So they knew that Jesus was someone who was very much challenging and flouting Sabbath, or was bringing in a theology of Sabbath that was in conflict with certain others who were around there.
I think it's also important that we keep in mind who Mark was writing to.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first gospel, and he was writing to the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so his audience, where he's setting, you know, this up, is the Jewish people. And I think that helps us understand why, in the beginning, he's going right into the story,
mm-hmm.
whereas the other gospels lead up to
mm-hmm.
the story.
Mm-hmm. It does, the Gospel of Mark does jump in with
right
both feet.
Both feet, yes.
You're right, yeah, it's like hits the ground, and it's immediately going 60 miles an hour. Yeah.
Well, we're only on chapter 3, and he's already irritated everybody in the
right.
the religious.
Yeah. yeah. And you can only imagine this man, you know, there's in verse 3, so everyone is watching Jesus, ready to pounce. And Jesus said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come forward."
mm-hmm.
How do you think he felt?
Who felt?
Oh, the guy with the withered hand. He probably thought a lynch mob was going to come after him.
Probably.
On the other hand, he's got a better chance of getting his hand healed than he's ever had before.
Maybe so, right? So you know his stakes are high, but he probably also feels, so he feels like, wow, this is a wonderful moment for me. He probably also feels, oh, I'm about to get implicated in some deep water here.
He's more concerned with his withered hand than he's worried about deep water.
Wow. Yeah. He wasn't going to be the one getting in trouble.
Well,
that's right.
It'd still be a weird moment, right? To know that, like, you're in the middle of this drama and that you're going to be the excuse, even if at the same time, you know, you're not going to say, never mind, I'm good.
Right.
You'd just be astonished.
Mm. Yeah.
Is there any social justice significance to the man with the withered hand who, and I don't know, so I'm hoping you do, he's not been able to work because he's had a withered hand, and perhaps the safety net that should have been provided in the culture was not available. Kind of like there's no ancient analogy for SSI. And now his not only his hand, but his ability to provide for himself and his family would be restored.
A withered hand doesn't prevent
you. Or is that
complete
fabrication?
No,
a withered hand doesn't prevent you from working. You still have the other hand.
Well, but it certainly limits your capacities.
Well, our pastor only had a withered hand. He didn't have any hand at all. And you never knew it.
Yeah, 2,000 years ago, it's a different story.
You probably need to do manual labor.
Yeah, it was probably less dramatic at that time.
Well, I don't think you can argue that having one hand instead of two does not diminish your capacities in some regard.
Right. But it doesn't diminish your capacity to contribute.
Granted. But, I mean, I think it's a fair speculation about the text, though, in that a person with you know, in a society where they would have probably been a peasant.
We're interjecting now.
Well,
it could have been a wealthy man. Who knows?
It could have been, but almost all of Jesus' followers were
right.
of the peasant class.
Yeah,
it seems, but.
He had a withered hand, that's all we know.
Yeah. And so Jesus puts this question to the people gathered. Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save life or to kill? And they just looked at him. They didn't say anything. And this elicits one of the most emotional responses of Jesus anywhere in the Gospels. He looked around at them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart. Does that, what does that phrase hardness of heart call to mind for you?
The Pharaoh.
Pharaoh, right. Yeah. Pharaoh. And his unwillingness to let the people go, right? And so that phrase hardness of heart has deep significance in the scriptures as being in a position of opposing God's work. But lest we get too sure of ourselves, the disciples will be accused of having hardness of heart just a few chapters later in the gospel. So even Jesus' closest associates aren't above being in that position as well. But and then he says to the man, stretch out your hand, and he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And then the Pharisees go out and immediately conspire with the Herodians against him how to destroy him. So it starts very early.
Now, who are the Herodians?
That's a great question. It's a point of some speculation, because I think that's the only place where anyone is referred to as the Herodians are referred to as a group. And the Herod family was a local dynasty, Palestinian dynasty of half Jewish family that were appointed by the Roman emperor as kings and local rulers. So Herod the Great was the ruler when Jesus was born, as we hear in the Gospel of Luke. You know, he's the one, Matthew. He's the one who is so paranoid when the Magi come, and that a king has been born. Jesus has been born king of the Jews, and so he has the baby boys ordered to be slaughtered. That is Herod the Great. And so Herod is the Herod family is this family of kind of political opportunists who are half Jewish, and so they kind of claim to be Jews. And in fact, Herod the Great helped rebuild and expand the temple in Jerusalem, but they were completely in bed with the Romans and the Roman emperor, and so they were part of the whole power structure. And at this point, Herod the Great's sons were rulers, and there were three of them, I think. One of them was the one who, in chapter 6 of Mark, we hear about how he had John the Baptist beheaded. So they're kind of part of the local mafioso as well. But the thing is, the interesting thing is that they wouldn't have been natural if we're talking about the Herodians as kind of the Herod family and their people. They would not have been natural allies with the Pharisees. The Pharisees normally wouldn't have been allies with the Herod family. But here, they seem to have found a common enemy. And so it's kind of peculiar that they become allies because they have a common enemy.
The other this was that arguably the Pharisees are about to do work on the Sabbath too by going off to try to plan up this.
Oh, that's interesting, right? Right.
That when he's talking about what, you know, if you're going to break the Sabbath, it's better to do it to save a life or to kill a life. And it's sort of, well,
right.
You've just shown what your intent is.
That's a really interesting observation. Yeah. Good. Let's go to chapter 6. Chapter 6, 1 to 6. Would someone care to read that?
He left that place and came to his hometown, and his disciples followed him. On the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astounded. They said, "Where did this man get all this? What is this wisdom that's been given to him? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? Is it not this, the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joses and Judas and Simeon? Are they not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. Then Jesus said to them, "Prophets are not without honor, except in their hometown, and among their own kin, and in their own house." And he could do no deed of power there, except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and cured them. And he was amazed at their unbelief.
My mom was on the call committee of the church I grew up in recently, in Minnesota. And she said, "Scott, why don't you put your name in for this, for you know, come back to Fergus Falls, come back to Bethlehem."
Sounds like a harder thing.
Not in my hometown, Mom. So once again, on the Sabbath, what happens here? He could do no works of power.
He began to teach too.
Yep. He began to teach. So again, it's controversy on the Sabbath. It's not quite controversy about the Sabbath, but nonetheless, it's on the Sabbath, and he runs into trouble again. What's this about? Why won't they accept him?
He was one of theirs.
Was he just too familiar, sort of like, you know?
No, he was the carpenter.
He was too ordinary for them? So
carpenter's
he seems,
son, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's a total power struggle.
Yeah.
No,
it's also human nature.
Well, is it human nature because they were jealous of him, or what do you think it is?
Well, they couldn't accept that he could speak with authority when he came from such a common background.
Yeah.
They even named his brothers and sisters.
Right.
Not his sisters, just named his brothers.
Yeah.
He says, "He's the brother of so-and-so and so-and-so. And he's the son of Mary and Joseph." You know, how can he know all this stuff?
Yeah, where did he get all this
stuff?
Where did he get
all this
stuff? He didn't learn it here.
Yeah, right. Right. So they're just highly suspicious. And
they don't believe.
Yeah. Do you think it's that they would expect something more if he's just too ordinary for them and so they wouldn't accept it, or?
I think when you know somebody, you sort of think that you know sort of what they're capable of and what they're like, and if he's changed a lot from when they last saw him,
yeah,
then they might just think, you know, they knew what they expected and they didn't see anything else.
Right.
Sort of like the expert has to be more than 50 miles away.
Huh. Oh,
yeah,
wow, that's good.
And a box of slides, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's good.
But we should remember, too, that Mark neither met nor knew Jesus personally. He was a disciple, a follower of Paul. And what he writes from what Paul told him. So we're reading the gospel according to Paul, even though it says the gospel according to Mark.
Well, you know, those are speculative. in terms of the source of the script, but that's one theory.
Yeah, Mark did not know Christ.
Yeah, I mean, that's
not
one.
Not personally.
That's one. I mean, he's not named among the disciples.
No,
yeah.
No, he's, but he's named as a follower of Paul.
John Mark, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he, what we're hearing is a third person's report as he learned it from someone who did know Christ and met Christ, even in a supernatural way.
Mm-hmm.
Even Paul never met Christ in person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except on the road to Damascus.
Yeah. What I'd like to do here is I'd like to kind of pause in our conversation and ask about your observation, your observance of Sabbath in your life, and both what you grew, what you perhaps you experienced growing up, and how you keep Sabbath, or perhaps don't in ways you'd like to, or what does that mean for you to keep Sabbath, to observe Sabbath in your life? And what has it meant, perhaps, in your life to maybe when you were younger, too, or with your parents, or your grandparents?
Well, I don't know about in Fergus, but in Sleepy Eye, we had what they called the Blue Laws.
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up, you'd be familiar with the Blue Laws, and you weren't. But the Blue Laws dictated that in our town of about 3,500, there would be no stores open, commercial stores open on Sunday, but they would allow one gas station to be open, but it rotated between the gas stations. And so you had the authorities enforcing the Sabbath. Of course, that's years ago,
mm-hmm.
and they don't do that anymore, unfortunately. But the Blue Laws were a part of my growing up
uh-huh.
experience.
So stores would be, there wouldn't be commercial activity going on. Things would be closed, people wouldn't go shopping.
Yeah, I mean,
how about others?
That was for family day.
Yeah.
I mean, in addition to observing the Sabbath at church, there'd always be a big dinner and gathering of close family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then, you know, it really struck me, Scott, this second chapter verse where it says, Sabbath was made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath, and how that's presently practiced by the majority of folks in the United States. It's, you know, a day to have a cup of coffee, read the paper, and look at all the ads, and then go shopping.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
The big thick paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the stores are full. My father-in-law was a farmer in Minnesota, and we were having a lot of rain in June that year, and he had cut his hay and raked. It dried and he raked it. And then came Sunday, when it was perfectly sunny and a great day to make hay. And he wasn't baling yet, but we were just putting it up loose. And I said to him, I said, Art, I said, you know, this is, and the neighbors are all out putting up their hay. I said, Art, I says, isn't this a good day to put up your hay? It's sunny and it's dry and it's ready to be taken off the field. He says, I think it'll be dry tomorrow as well.
Mm.
So that was his way to
yeah.
observe the Sabbath. He wasn't going to be on the Sabbath.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I remember it very well.
Yeah.
It'll be dry tomorrow as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the Christian tradition, there's been kind of an evolving sense of what the Sabbath is, right? Because the Jewish Sabbath is Saturday. And
sundown Friday.
Sorry?
Sundown Friday, right?
Yep. Sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday. And so when we're talking about Sabbath here, that's what we're talking about. And within the Christian tradition, we're going to talk about this as we move toward the end, their last passage, and then we're going to talk about something called the eighth day. There was a sense early on that Christian observance of Sabbath was transferred to Sunday as the day of resurrection. Christian observance of Sabbath has meant a variety of things. There have been some traditions, and certainly it was more common a couple of generations ago, of that there wouldn't be any commercial activity going on Sundays. Stores would be closed. My grandparents didn't do any work on Sundays, you know, like no housework or anything. When Luther talked about the Sabbath in the Ten Commandments in his catechism, he said observance of the Sabbath is studying the Word and worship. That's what observance of the Sabbath is. It's immersing oneself in the promises of God, and worship. But increasingly in our own day, even that has kind of fallen, right? And so, you know, kids have soccer practice on Sunday morning and everything else. So it's become increasingly a challenging thing to think about what do we mean by Sabbath? And we've gone so far in saying, well, let's not be legalistic about observing these things, that one wonders what's left. Maybe a degree of legalism is helpful at times if you've completely lost any sense of observance. But I'd like us now to go to the very end of the Gospel of Mark. This is the, after chapter 6, this is the next time that Sabbath appears as a topic is at the very end.
What are we looking for?
We're looking at Mark chapter 15, starting with verse 42. And we're going to read 15:42 all the way through 16:8. The very end of the gospel. Let's read the first chunk, verses 42 to 47. Would someone care to read that? Verses 42 to 47.
Now when evening had come, because it was a preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent council member, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, coming, taking courage, went into Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate marveled that he was already dead, and summoning the centurion, he asked him if he had been dead for some time. So when he found out from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. Then he bought fine linen, took him down and wrapped him in the linen, and he laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of the rock, and rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. And Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, observed where he was laid.
Thank you. So, Good Friday. Jesus is dead, and it's the day before the Sabbath, and Jesus is laid in the tomb by Joseph of Arimathea. So, Sabbath. Would someone read 16:1-8? I'll read it. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices. so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. So, who rested on the Sabbath? Here.
They rested on the Sabbath.
Well, they. But Jesus is dead in the tomb on the Sabbath. After all that controversy about on the Sabbath, finally Jesus rested on the Sabbath. He was dead and in the tomb. And so Sabbath here, Sabbath day is a kind of, is a kind of lacuna in the text. It's just a space between these two scenes, right? The Sabbath is a kind of the space between.
It's a void.
Between the void space in the text, right? Between Jesus' burial and when they go to the tomb and find the tomb empty. And I just find this very, very interesting. That after all this conflict with Jesus about what he is doing on the Sabbath, he is dead, finally, on the Sabbath. And it's really marked there. It's the day before, the day after, and the day between is Jesus in the tomb. And then those verses of chapter 16, when the women come to the tomb, find it empty, and are told that he is not there, and they run away, terrified.
So the only witnesses we have are the two centurions, huh, regarding the tomb? Nobody interviewed them.
Well, but and Mark doesn't. Those centurions aren't in Mark's.
Or the guards, they were, I don't know if they were centurions, but they were two guards placed at the tomb so that they couldn't make like they could steal his body and say he'd been raised from the dead. But they were.
But I don't think they're in Mark, though. I think they're in.
It doesn't mention them. In the other gospels, it that there were guards put at the tomb in order to prevent any pilfering.
Right, yeah.
But nobody ever interviewed him. What happened?
Now, the process for a Jewish burial at that time, especially if somebody died in the evening, wouldn't they put them in the tomb and the next morning go and anoint the body?
I think that's probably true. I can't say that I know a great deal about that. But with the women coming to the tomb, I mean, the reason they were going there was to give kind of proper and respectful burial rites.
Right,
to,
but it was
a day later, right.
Than they would usually have done.
Exactly, yeah.
It was on their Sabbath, right?
Yeah. In fact, one interpreter that I was reading suggested that when Jesus is buried, when Joseph of Arimathea buries him, they're suggesting because he needed to get into the tomb, because it was, they didn't want to, they needed to get him into the tomb before the Sabbath.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It was a rush job.
There was a rush job. It wasn't a proper burial. It was a really a kind of a final indignity of it all. It was a, and so the fact that they had to go, these women had to go and do that, was, you know, a day hence, was because that anointing didn't happen before.
But is it a Jewish tradition to bury within 24 hours of death?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. So we see here part of the Christian evolving sense of Sabbath and how Christians come to understand and observe Sunday as Sabbath right here, where the first day of the week, Sunday, is the day of Jesus' resurrection. Did finally rest on that Sabbath and then rose on the first day of the week, and that day then becomes the day of rejoicing for the Christian people. And there was a notion in the early centuries of calling Sunday the eighth day. The idea here was that creation happened on in the 7 days of Genesis, and that Jesus' resurrection happens on Sunday, the first day of the week, but his resurrection is a new day for all of creation, and so it's the Creator bringing creation to its ultimate fruition. And so they called it the eighth day. They called it Sunday the eighth day of creation. A sort of a new Sabbath, the eighth day. And I just want to read this little passage from a book called Receiving the Day, Christian Practices for Opening the Gift of Time. It's by Dorothy Bass, who some of you may know. She's going to be up here next week. She's on the board of Holden, and she is a writer and a scholar. And she writes, early Christians captured the experience of resurrection, when they called the first day of the week the eighth day. On the first day, they believed, God began the creation of the heavens and the earth. Christ's rising on another first day, centuries later, meant that God was beginning a new creation. The future was already breaking into the present. Their experience testified, the healing for which all creation yearns was near enough to touch. The seven-day week could not hold the fullness of time. So the first day, which embraced eternity as well as its own 24 hours spilled over. The first day, therefore, was also the eighth day. So, there you have it. The eighth day, Sabbath. Sabbath controversies in Mark. Sabbath that kind of jumps the rails and becomes a celebration of the resurrection and new creation.
So how should the Sabbath be honored today in today's society?
That's a great question. What do you think?
I see very little honoring in our society of the Sabbath compared to the blue laws, which is government dictated.
Yeah. Well, I think that...
That's quite a contrast to
that. Yeah, I think that we can't... We can't assume that we will have kind of societal support, right? We can't assume that there will be laws and stuff like that.
Is it watching football? Is that part of the Sabbath?
That's a great question. I think the question is, what does it mean to rest? What does it mean to rest? And what does that look like to really and genuinely rest? And this resting is is kind of the deepest, is the deepest kind of statement of faith in some ways. So you're rest, you're letting the world in your life be God's, and not thinking that you have to hold up the sky with your own running around.
But I think the in today's society, nothing has changed as far as worship. Although we, as Christians, we worship on Sunday rather than on Saturday. We keep the worship service as the high point of the Sabbath, and that everything stems from there. Whatever you play or do for relaxation beyond that is varies from individual family to individual family.
Right.
But the same thing, I think the Sunday should remain a special day, different from the others, and the focus of that day should be on attending the worship service.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the eighth day for many pastors is their day.
Yeah. That's true. Our offices are closed on Monday. Can you believe that?
One of the interesting parts was the second, the Deuteronomy section, talking about resting because you were slaves in Egypt, and the need for fairness and to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to rest is, I think, still valid, even when not everybody is Christian and going to be celebrating in the same way, to make the opportunity for people to be able to rest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But that raises a good question, too, because in their, 400 years of slavery in Egypt, did the Jews worship and honor the Sabbath? They kept the tradition all the way through. Of course, Moses didn't have the word at that point. He got that after they left Egypt. So anyway, they didn't have the Ten Commandments.
That's true, yeah. The Sabbath hadn't really been instituted at that point.
Had not been instituted. But I'm sure the Egyptians didn't give them a Saturday off. You know?
Right, yeah.
But there it had not been instituted at that time, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this question of rest and Sabbath observance is, in this culture of 24/7, man, there are a few questions I think that are more important to wrestle with in terms of how do we actually live out our faith in contemporary society, and how do we give a witness to God in a society that just wants to go? How do we say no? It's important to rest. How, you know, we don't talk about leisure a lot in the context of faith, but that's part of the point.
It just occurred to me that in the months of June, July, and August, lobster fishermen in Maine are not allowed to go and haul their traps. They're allowed to set traps, but not on Sunday. not for 3 months. I'm curious to know if there's other, you know, resource-based economies that you guys know of where there are restrictions and activity on Sundays. And the other thing I'm thinking of is that I believe, at least in the deer hunting season in Maine, they're not allowed to hunt on Sundays.
Is that a religious observance?
Oh, God, no.
No, I wouldn't think so.
No. But, I mean, I think it probably has roots to religious observance from probably 75 or 100 years ago. The lobstering part is a ecological management overlay. Why they would choose Sunday and not another day seems to be slanted towards a historical Sabbath observance. And then the hunting, I don't know. I mean, that might even go back further. So
this is interesting. He brings up Maine, because Maine has replaced Washington as one of the least church states in the Union.
Yeah,
we used to be 49th, and Maine displaced us in the last 10
really?
Years. And then 50th is Oregon. They're at the bottom of the list.
When we go back home, we'll switch that.
Are you from Maine?
Yeah,
they have the same battle that we have. But I wanted to add one thing. When I was stationed in Vietnam, we had a team of six doctors all at this clinic taking care of the soldiers. And one of the six was a Jew, Orthodox. And I mean, he was Orthodox. he did not eat in the mess hall the whole year. His food is brought to him by a rabbi. And when the rabbi unpacked the food, then he would lay out his meals for the week. And then the rabbi would come the next week, and he'd lay out the meals for the next week. So it was a nice situation because he would not work on Saturday. And so he'd always work on Sunday, so the rest of us could have off. Anyway, he would not even turn on his electric shaver. He would not open the refrigerator door because that turned on the light. He sat and he ate the little flatbreads that they ate. I forget the name of it, but he ate the little flatbreads. And then he laid in bed. He did not shave. And he laid in bed and he read his religious book, Torah. Through that day, but he did do no work. And here, 40 years later, I can remember his example. So I think as Christians, if we set the example within our own community of going to church, honoring the Sabbath, it'll have an effect on others around us. And maybe that's our best witness we can do in our modern society. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it stuck with me what he
did. Yeah.
You know, we made a definite decision with the girls, and you know, three girls playing soccer through the years,
that
they would not advance to the above the recreational,
right?
Because they played their games on Sunday morning, and that Sunday morning was, you know, Sunday was time set aside.
My girls, one girl has given up into that. It's unfortunately, they play soccer on Sunday morning and Sunday go to church. That's unfortunate, but that's what they do. So they can advance.
We got to wrap up, but thanks everyone.
Thank you. That was very interesting.